Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
Today we have Casey Hilvick, the Executive Director of Umpqua Watersheds, joining us to discuss the history of Earth Day and upcoming events. We also have Tracy Maxwell with Umpqua Valley Audubon Society to discuss their upcoming events. Melanie McKinnon, representing Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, discussing Earth Day events hosted by the Umpqua Transportation Electrification Team and co-sponsored by Pacific Power, DCGWC, 4th, Umpqua Watersheds, and Aviva Health. Thank you all for speaking on this episode of Living Downstream. Tracy, please tell me a little bit about UVAS and how your work is related to Earth Day.
Sure, Jessica. Thanks for inviting me here today. I'd just like to read our little bio that's on our website because it speaks right to how our work is related to Earth Day. So I'm just going to start with that. Umpqua Valley Audubon Society is a chapter of the National Audubon Society serving Central Coast Douglas County. National Audubon has been in existence for 100 years and is protecting birds and wildlife in their habitats for the benefit of all life. Among National Audubon's priorities are saving the most important places for birds, combating climate change, and mitigating its impacts. Building bird-friendly communities and cities, protecting our seas and shores, and collaborating with foresters, rangers, farmers, and other landowners to make working lands work for birds. Actually, one of the reasons that Earth Day was started was because of the widespread use of the chemical DDT and the dramatic decline of many bird species as a result of that poisoning. In my work with Umpqua Valley Audubon Society, I'm working to improve the capacity of the organization and to expand our profile in Douglas County. I'm reaching out to schools and other organizations offering programs, and I'm building a volunteer program to help continue this work into the future. I have an Earth Day ad because we're going to be at Farmers Market this Saturday that I'd also like to read to you all, and you can find this again at our website. It says, Umpqua Valley Audubon is partnering with Umpqua Watersheds, the Umpqua Valley Farmers Market, and the United States Forest Service to celebrate Earth Day 2023. We will be at the Farmers Market this Saturday, April 22nd, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. We will have tables set up with several fun crafts for willing participants, and we have created a Farmers Market scavenger hunt as well. We will also have a mystery guest or two, and our brand new, hot off the press, Birds of the Umpqua Valley Pocket Guides will be there to show everyone. You can find us at the far end of the market, near where the musicians usually set up. We hope to see you there this Saturday, April 22nd, at the Umpqua Valley Farmers Market in Roseburg, and that's at 1771 West Harvard Avenue. We have a few other exciting events coming up. One thing that's going on soon, Wednesday, May 3rd, at the Public Library, is an event called Oak Woodlands in the Western Oregon. Steve Denny will discuss preservation and restoration of the oak woodlands in Western Oregon. And this is an in-person event, and it starts at 7, May 3rd. We also have a wonderful offering on May 7th. It's at Cooper Creek Reservoir, and it's going to be a birding trip. And it starts at 8:30, and Keith Pfeiffer will lead this birding outing. It is only limited to 12 participants, so you'll need to contact Stacy Burley to register, and all that information is also on our website. Also, we're having our annual meeting very soon. That's going to be on May 10th in 2023, as we know. Social hour starts around 4:30. It's going to be at the Triple Oak Wine Vault up in Oakland. The meeting and program will begin at 6. And finally, Can't forget this one. We're going to have a green heron nest survey and family-friendly pub crawl on Wednesday, May 24th from 5 to 7. And this is an informal survey to count green heron nests in downtown Roseburg. And again, more information on all these events is at umpquaaudubon.org.
Thank you, Tracy, so much for sharing this information. I hope the public can join some of these events.
I do too. And we're so excited that Earth Day is happening this year in such a big way in Roseburg. I hope to see everybody at Farmers Market.
And Umpqua Watersheds will be at the Farmers Market as well. And we will be having our own activity where you can make seed bombs with wildflowers that can be distributed around locally to help the pollinator species. So come check that out. Well, thank you, Tracy, very much.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
Yeah. So, Melanie, please tell us a little bit about the history of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition and how your work is related to Earth Day.
Sure, thanks. The Douglas County Global Warming Coalition is an all-volunteer organization founded in 2003. We're a catalyst for promoting a healthy climate for a community and future generations by identifying and sharing solutions through awareness, advocacy, and collaboration. What we do today can and will make a difference. So that's really important to all of us. We're even more powerful when we work together. A few of our efforts focus on transportation, energy, and agriculture. So that's a few of the things that Douglas County Global Warming Coalition works on in our community, but we work on a variety of things, and we really encourage the community to reach out and let us know what is important to them and what their ideas are. So we really want to hear from the community and have them be involved in our organization, because that's what it's really all about. They're a part of our world and our community. And so we really want to connect with them. And that's a lot of what Earth Day is about too. And so that's one of the reasons that we really think that Earth Day is important. And we really love the Earth Day activities that happen here in Douglas County and around the world.
Wonderful. Thank you. Do you want to talk about your upcoming Earth Day event?
Yes. We're proud to be helping with the Earth Day EV Ride and Drive celebration. The event will be near Costco at the Viva Health parking lot at 150 Kenneth Ford Drive in Roseburg. It'll be a family-friendly event, which is really great. We love that. We love to see people of all ages coming out to events like these. There will be a lot going on to celebrate Earth Day. We're getting together so that the community can share how we each honor the earth and learn ways that we can each reduce our impact on the earth. We really want to help people find actions that are right for them to take if they're ready to take on another step and share things that they've done and have fun with that. Attendees can learn the ins and outs of electric vehicles through an electric vehicle and e-bike display that will be there on hand at the event. You can even enjoy a test drive of an electric vehicle, which I think is super cool. There'll be a variety of different models that will be there at the event. So people are getting really excited for that. Local organizations will have a variety of activities that share how you can be a good steward of our earth. So we're getting together to have fun. And our goal for this day is to reduce some of the stresses we might all be feeling around these overwhelming issues. Been a few years since many of these organizations have had an event together on Earth Day. We've done this similar events like these in years past, but it's been a while. We've heard from people that they miss getting together, and we do too. So it's going to be fun. Community members and organizers are looking forward to gathering together to celebrate Earth Day. There's several different organizations that are going to be out there. Some of these are Unleash, which is an education organization. the North Umpqua Foundation, a great environmental organization in our area, Bike Walk Umpqua, which is encourages different forms of transportation for people to get active, Umpqua Biochar Education Team, Umpqua Community College, Energy Trust, which has incentives for people to take on energy projects and helps them do that easier. And NeighborWorks Umpqua will be there. And the Native Plant Society, another great organization, as well as Blue Zones UC Veg. So there's going to be some really terrific groups out there that can help folks explore ways to reduce their impact on the earth. And there's a lot of ways that people can do that, including low and no cost ways in many areas of their life. This can include in your kitchen, your yard or garden, how you get around town, the foods you choose to eat, and many more. These groups can help us get started with ideas that we can use today and throughout the year. And so this is a really fun event where these organizations will have ideas and resources, activities, and raffle prizes too. We're pretty excited about the raffle prizes that we have. We'll have a variety of those from small to big. The grand prize giveaway is an electric bike. So that's pretty cool. And there's going to be a food truck at the event too. Come check it out. Join us for the Earth Day EV ride and drive and celebration from noon to four.
Thank you so much, Melanie. That was some great information, and I hope everyone goes and checks it out. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Jessica, may I add something?
Yeah.
I think that Liz Gaynor from the BLM and Audubon will also be there at tabling as well.
Yeah. They will. Yeah, that's going to be really cool. I'm so glad that they're going to be joining us, as will Umpqua Watersheds and the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. So we're really looking forward to the event. I've missed this one. There's going to be some fantastic organizations out there, and we're so happy that the Umpqua Transportation Electrification Team is presenting this, and really happy that we're getting the support from the co-sponsors, from Umpqua Watersheds, 4th Pacific Power, Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, Aviva Health, and my apologies if I've missed anyone else that is being a part of this. It's a great event, community event, and please join us. We really want to see you out there. Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. And I appreciate both of you guys taking the time to join us today and provide information about your organizations and these upcoming events.
Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah,
Thank you, of course. Jessica. Nice to be here. I'm so excited to get up to Aviva too. That's going to be fun.
Casey, please tell us a little bit about Umpqua Watersheds and how your work relates to Earth Day.
Thanks, Jessica. Umpqua Watersheds was incorporated as a 501(c) in 1995. We started as a volunteer organization in the 80s by a group of people who were concerned about sustainable logging in the Umpqua Watersheds, pollution in local streams and rivers, and a desire to promote more wilderness areas. Since our inception, Umpqua Watersheds has worked to protect and restore the ecosystems of the Umpqua River watershed. Our organization recognizes that environmental conservation and protection is not a one-day event, but a continuous process that requires ongoing efforts and initiatives. To this end, Umpqua Watersheds has developed several programs and initiatives that work toward celebrating Earth Day all year long. These include restoration projects. We undertake numerous restoration projects throughout the year to help restore degraded ecosystems and prevent further environmental degradation. These projects include planting trees, removing invasive species, restoring riparian areas, and river cleanup events. Our education programs are well known. We have events throughout the year to raise awareness and the importance of environmental conservation and protection. We have a very thriving AmeriCorps program, as evidenced by Living Downstream, hosted by our AmeriCorps, Jessica Saxton. These programs include workshops, seminars, field trips, and are designed to educate the public on various environmental issues and encourage them to take action. We also are advocates for public policy. We engage in working with various groups. We're very proud of our collaboration with multiple groups, and we try to influence environmental policies and regulations at the local, state, and federal levels. Our organization works to promote sustainable land use practices, protect endangered species, and we advocate for environmental conservation. We're also a thriving volunteer organization. We offer volunteer opportunities throughout the year, allowing individuals to participate in various restoration and conservation projects. This provides an opportunity for people to take an active role in protecting the environment and contributing to conservation efforts. Finally, we have community events, as evidenced by our Earth Day events this coming Saturday, April 22nd. We host community events throughout the year to promote environmental awareness and conservation, including outdoor activities, film screenings, and other community-oriented events that bring people together to celebrate and protect the environment. Umpqua Watersheds works to celebrate Earth Day all year long by engaging in a wide variety of programs and initiatives that promote environmental conservation and protection. And that the key at the heart of it all is working with our collaborations like Umpqua Valley Audubon Society and the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. These organizations and many more help us really expand who we are as an organization, and we're able to develop programs because of their great ideas and share the ideas that we've come up with.
Thank you, Casey. That was great. I definitely agree that we can do more together, and it's amazing having all of these other organizations working together. We may think that man-made climate change as a recent development, but even decades ago, the country was a polluted place in need of help. Public lands were dilapidated, factories were free to dump toxins into our waters, and industries would churn out pollutants into our air without regulations. As a result, species began collapsing. Oysters, for example, were gone from the New York harbor by early as the 20th century. Around the time of the first Earth Day in 1970, people were starting to realize that pollution and toxic waste could lead to cancer and other serious health issues. And now, roughly 1 billion people celebrate Earth Day every year, which is amazing. So, Casey, would you like to provide some information on the history of Earth Day?
Absolutely, Jessica. Earth Day is celebrated with a variety of events and activities around the world. Some of them, since COVID-19, are going to be held virtually, such as webinars and online workshops and virtual tours of eco-friendly initiatives. There are also physical events being held, such as community cleanup drives, tree planting events, and education programs on sustainability. In 1970, as you mentioned, the world was facing significant environmental challenges that led to the first Earth Day. These challenges were the result of a range of factors, including population growth, industrialization, and the increasing use of synthetic materials. Some of the key environmental challenges that were present at the time included air pollution, water pollution, deforestation, wildlife extinction, and climate change. The first day was a response to these environmental challenges and aimed to raise public awareness about the importance of environmental protection. The event was intended to bring people together from all walks of life to highlight the need for action on environmental issues and to demand that governments and businesses take steps to address them. The success of the first Earth Day led to the creation of many new environmental laws and regulations, including the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act, which helped to mitigate some of the environmental problems of the time. Earth Day was started by a senator from Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson, and he was inspired by the student anti-war protest of the time, came up with the idea, how do we bring people together to bring attention to the growing environmental crisis and the need to address these issues? As a result of his work, Congress really got involved, as I mentioned before, passing these important laws, environmental laws, and this has created this annual event of Earth Day on April 22nd.
Wonderful. Thank you. Being good stewards of the Earth should not happen only on Earth Day, but every day. Did you know that 3.5 billion toothbrushes are sold worldwide each year? Most get lost in the recycling process or end up in a landfill or even make their way into oceans and rivers. Toothbrushes are made out of polypropylene plastic and nylon, which can take up to 500 or more years to decompose. And another common household item that we use is toilet paper tubes, which, as we know, are made from cardboard, and these take 2 months to decompose in landfills. A plastic bottle sticks around for much longer, which can take around 450 years to break down. But instead of turning to the trash bin, you could turn these toilet paper tubes into an awesome telescope or a flower planter. Before you throw something away, think about whether it can be recycled or repurposed. You can always limit waste by reducing the amount of things you buy or buying from sustainable sources. Casey, do you have other ways to limit waste and use sustainable resources in our daily life?
Sure do, Jessica. Reducing waste and using sustainable resources in our daily lives is important to help protect the environment and conserve resources for future generations. Here are some ways that we can limit waste and use sustainable resources in our daily lives. Reduce, reuse, and recycle. One of the easiest ways to limit waste is to follow the three R's of waste management: reduce, reuse, and recycle. This means reducing the water we generate, reusing items as much as possible, and recycling materials that can be reused. As you mentioned, use reusable products. Using reusable products such as cloth bags, water bottles, and food containers instead of disposable ones can significantly reduce waste. Conserve water. Conserving water can help to reduce the amount of energy needed to treat and transport water, as well as conserve a precious natural resources. We can do this by taking shorter showers, fixing leaks, and using water-efficient appliances. Use energy-efficient appliances. Using energy-efficient appliances such as light bulbs, refrigerators, and washing machines can help to reduce energy use and lower carbon emissions. Another thing we can do is eat a plant-based diet. Eating a plant-based diet can reduce the amount of resources needed to produce food, as well as reduce greenhouse gas emissions associated with animal agriculture. Another thing we can do is to support sustainable products and businesses. Supporting businesses that use sustainable practices and products can help to promote sustainability and encourage more businesses to adopt sustainable practices. We can also use public transportation or carpooling. Using public transportation or carpooling can help to reduce the number of cars on the road, which can help to reduce air pollution and conserve fossil fuels. And finally, one of my favorite, plant trees. Planting trees can help to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, as well as provide habitat for wildlife and prevent, and it also prevents erosion. Another thing is, don't cut the trees down. You know, keep the trees where they are, especially for old growth. They really maintain the ecosystem. There's something happening in there that has been happening for hundreds of years. And if we keep those old growth trees and manage our forests as we should manage them, the trees will continue to be such an enormous benefit to the planet. These are a few ways that we can limit waste and use sustainable resources in our daily lives. By making small changes in our daily habits, we can help to protect the environment and conserve resources for future generations.
Thank you. I completely agree with you. Those are some great tips on how to or limit waste and use sustainable resources daily. And I do agree, trees are amazing and they do a great job at sequestering carbon and play so many more roles in the ecosystem. And they definitely deserve to be protected and planted more often. So Earth Day Oregon is an annual event that happens on April 22nd, where multiple organizations come together to celebrate Earth Day, of course. And many of these organizations are putting on their own events or coming together to do a huge event for the community to honor the Earth. And Umpqua Watersheds, along with some other organizations, is involved in the Earth Day Oregon campaign. So I wanted to mention that Earth Day Oregon was launched in 2019, and the campaign has grown rapidly and has helped raise more than $700,000 for participating nonprofit partnerships. And in 2023, there is currently over 100 nonprofits, 300 plus local businesses, and thousands of community members that will be coming together to take action throughout April and on Earth Day to celebrate the Earth. So, Casey, what will Umpqua Watersheds be doing as part of the Earth Day Oregon campaign?
Yeah, we're really proud to be part of Earth Day Oregon. Our president, board president Janice Reed, got us involved. And we're one of the few nonprofits in Southern Oregon, if not the only nonprofit, that is participating this year in Earth Day Oregon. A lot of nonprofits in Portland and Eugene and the bigger communities are there. But it's the first time that we've represented Earth Day Oregon, and we're really excited about it because of our partnership. Our friends at Too Shy Brewing are donating $1 off of every pint of Oregon Trail IPA that is sold on April 22nd. So a lot of our friends will be there. We'll be there and really appreciate them supporting us. We also have Oregon Serigraphics, who have made 50 of our Earth. We also have our friends at Oregon Serigraphics, who produced 50 T-shirts, the Umpqua Watersheds T-shirts are really cool. They say more nature, less stress. They have the Umpqua Watersheds logo on the sleeve, and they gave us 50 of those to sell to raise money for our organization. So when you come out to one of our events, whether it's at the Aviva event or at our annual banquet on May 7th, you can purchase one of those T-shirts for $20. And the proceeds will go to support our various environmental initiatives that we're doing to help save the planet. And finally, we have our friends at Medicine Flower, who are longtime supporters of Umpqua Watersheds and do so much for our community. They're donating 10% of everything they sell at Medicine Flower in the month of April to support our organization as part of the Earth Day initiative. So it's really great that we are first-time participants in Earth Day Oregon, and we have three wonderful organizations that are supporting what we're trying to do to make a difference in our community and for the world.
I agree. Thank you. That's amazing that you guys have all come together, and they're helping to support Earth Day and support Umpqua Watersheds and other organizations. That's very amazing. And I also wanted to add, every year there's a theme for Earth Day, and 2023 is continuing the theme from 2022, which is invest in our planet. In keeping with the theme, Earth Day 2023 will center on accelerating solutions to combat our greatest threat, climate change, and to activate everyone, government, citizens, and businesses to do their part. So theme for this year again is invest in our planet. And I hope everyone comes out and enjoys Earth Day events and maybe does something to help support our planet.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream. And now, a special segment brought to you by Green Teacher.
Green Teacher's main office is located on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Huron-Wendat, Haudenosaunee, and Mississauga peoples. This territory is covered by the Williams Treaty.
You know, they often have multi-stems, sometimes there's several stems or trunks coming from the base. And yet we all still have this image in our mind's eye of a tree, like how a young child would draw a tree. Everybody I know that's been to a giant sequoia forest or a coast redwood forest or some of the big old eucalypt forests, it puts them in their little, like, makes you realize where you sit in the world. It's often life-changing. I was blind to trees, yet I was a horticulturist. And I think that's the first bit, is we sort of need to get people to see trees.
Testing, testing. Hey, I'm Ian.
And I'm Sophia.
And welcome to Talking with Green Teachers.
This is the Environmental Education Podcast, where we discuss recent developments, big ideas, and creative approaches to teaching green. In this episode...
I think trees are just a big example of woody plants. You know, they're obvious, it makes it a lot easier for people to get those concepts across. But then there's the benefits of trees. You know, this idea that in the world, it's great when I hear teachers getting young kids to understand how the trees are cooling their environment, providing ecosystem services and habitat for not just the big obvious things like, be they birds and the bigger animals.
He has walked past this grove of eucalypts probably hundreds of times, but something different catches his eye this morning. It's probably nothing new or even particularly remarkable. There's just something interesting about how the sun is illuminating the canopy branches. This is a snapshot of a typical day for arborist Ian Allen, who spends much of his time bushwalking throughout the Greater Blue Mountains World Heritage Wilderness Area in New South Wales, Australia. As part of his role as supervisor of natural areas, arboriculture, and open space at the Blue Mountains Botanic Garden Mount Toma, he manages over 200 hectares of forest. Ian joined our Ian to discuss the many lessons we can learn from trees, common tree misconceptions, and an upcoming project being done in partnership with a local First Nation.
In dynamic ecosystems, trees often represent stability. And despite being inanimate, there's lots happening in a tree's life, as a lot of books have been illuminating in recent times. What are some standout happenings in the lives of trees in your botanic garden?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's pretty obvious. I'm a tree person. I love trees. I'm a bit obsessed with them. and, you know, one of the things is that trees are so long-lived, like the majority of trees. They live a lot longer than us. You know, many of us don't even have a good frame of reference as to the time frames that trees live, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And the question sort of takes me back to a chapter in a Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold.
It's on the shelf.
And unfortunately, it's a chapter about cutting down a tree, but it's so beautiful in that it just marks as the Sawyer goes through the growth rings of this great old oak, it just marks the passing of time right through one side of the tree and out the other. And all these moments in time where that everything from birds roosting in the trees, you know, great snowstorms and wind events and weather events affecting the tree. And I always think about that. I always think about that when I look at these great old trees and you think, what has that tree seen? What's that tree felt? And I went through a big period where I didn't want to anthropomorphize trees, but more and more now I'm going back into that because I think that's one of the best ways to connect people with trees. And to a trained arborist, and which I am, you learn to study the trees and that they talk about the body language of trees. And you can see these clues in the shape of the tree and in the wood that it's put on in as to what it's experienced. And more and more these days you're looking even for things like hints as to what's living in the tree, you know, that the ecosystem benefits the tree has. And in our botanic gardens we have all those sorts of things. We're relatively young botanic gardens, yet the land that the botanic garden's on has some very, very old trees, some old eucalypts on it. And yeah, you look up into these things and you just think, wow, that tree has been here longer than white colonization of the land. It's had the Darug people, the First Nations people, inhabit the land here, and that I'm sure they understood even more about those trees, you know. And yeah, I guess that big long life stuff, there's just so many things going on in a tree that the tree has seen, and And it always excites me and makes me think.
You mentioned about anthropomorphizing, and this is something that I'm just always fascinated by. And my background is in nature interpretation and teaching through the land and through nature. And this was always a discussion point with colleagues, was to what extent, or should we anthropomorphize at all? And if so, to what extent should we do that? For you, is there a sweet spot in terms of bringing that anthropomorphism into it?
Yeah, I think I'm still trying to figure that sweet spot out. But I guess for me, I like to have a science-backed position on how we think about the trees. You know, there's been a lot written lately and some great books, The Hidden Life of Trees and things like that. But where perhaps it's a very easy to stray into the idea of trees talking or trees doing things that maybe aren't necessarily supported, like plant sentience is one of the hot topics that, yeah. I mean, you know, it really, really is a difficult thing. And I still think the sweet spot is using that human connection with trees, where we can anthropomorphize them and get people to understand the technical and scientific sides in human ways and emotional ways. But yeah, when we start, I still don't know if I'm okay with delving too far into the more esoteric and stretched out idea that the trees are just like us.
Yeah, I'm very much of the same mind. And I mean, on one hand, there's, say, the Ents from Lord of the Rings, which are very much sentient and can walk around. And I'm certainly resistant to go in that direction. Though when looking at communication and chemical signals, if it helps, say, kids understand to say something like, in a manner of speaking, trees are sort of talking to each other, I'm okay to go to about that line. Is that sort of a line that you're comfortable with?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that's the best way, and it's the nuances of language that do that for us. To just say it's flat out, the trees are talking. But yeah, like they are communicating, and that is like talking. It's their version of that.
And speaking of human stories, there's quite an interesting human story associated with Eucalyptus olsenii, one that's quite personal to you and your family. So I'll let you have the floor to tell us that tale.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. We all have these deeply personal connections with plants. And my connection to that tree in particular is that Eucalyptus olsenii is named after my uncle, who his name was another Ian Olsen. And he was a horticulturist and a landscape designer. And many, many years ago, long before I even was alive, he worked for the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney. And I'd always known in my story, like my mother had always mentioned that, you know, he was an avid bushwalker all over Australia. And, you know, he's like me, very, very tall, made for walking. And he used to, on his travels, he would also botanize everywhere he went, and he'd collect plant specimens. And he had friends who worked in the National Herbarium of New South Wales. And, you know, he was just an absolute freak when it came to identifying plants. And my mum had said, you know, your uncle's got a eucalypt named after him. And he'd found this, what's, I guess, a bit of an, like, to see it, it's not an outstandingly amazing tree, but deep in the bush down in the south coast of New South Wales, he'd come across this tree, which I always used to think, wow, how do you tell the difference between a eucalypt? There's up to 800 species of them. To a lot of people, they all look the same. And he'd seen this thing and said, that's different. And upon growing it, that we actually grow a specimen in the garden that I manage. And it's got a very unique, persistent fruit, like the gum nuts on it are quite obvious to someone who knows their trees. But yeah, he'd found this thing and sent us press specimen to his friend in a herbarium, and turned out it was a new species. And when I first started working at the Botanic Gardens a little over 7 years ago, we do a tour when we start of the National Herbarium. And I said to the botanist in there, I was like, oh, you know, this species, Eucalyptus olsenii, like my uncle discovered it. Any chance you could bring me the type specimens? And they were so kind. They brought out the box that contained these specimens, and in it were hand-drawn maps of the area that he'd drawn.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've actually still never been there. I was going to go on a very personal solo adventure into the bush a few years ago, but it was just before the big black summer 2019 fires.
Right.
in Australia, and And since then, I haven't been able to go down there. I believe the area was burnt quite badly in those bushfires. But I was just talking to a friend at work the other day, and he's like, I can't believe you haven't been there. And it's, I think I'm going to have to go this summer.
Yeah, well, summer is right around the corner for you in Australia as we approach winter here in Canada.
Yeah.
After holding his gaze on the canopy for an extra few seconds, he continues along his way, but now with a heightened awareness of the early morning light and its enchanting effects.
So you spend a lot of time talking with people about trees. What are some recurring questions?
Yeah, I mean, I'll get the negative one out of the way. Unfortunately, as an arborist and even in the Botanic Gardens, so many people ask us about tree safety, or, you know, can you make this tree safe, or is that branch going to fall on my house? And it's something we tackle a lot because it gets in the way of people connecting and understanding trees better. And, you know, it's this thing where it's a case-by-case basis, of course, as an arborist. Not all sure. trees are safe. There's trees that have branches in them that could fail, but the risk is so incredibly low. Yet it's so entrenched in a lot of people's way of thinking. You know, so many people think, oh, this tree's hanging over my house, it could fall on my house, and so on and so forth. And it's a tricky one, and we really try to steer around it into the positive side about talking about the benefits of trees, and those benefits far outweighing the risk, and that in our landscape there's hundreds of thousands of trees in an urban landscape, and they're everywhere, and the risk is so low that let's focus on the positives of trees, because then you get that into the good discussions and people start asking how old the tree is, you know, why is it the way? It's amazing how much people just don't know about trees. Down to simple things about their leaves and about what they're doing and about how long they live, you know. And I think it's exciting. It's kind of the how old is the tree? That's a really common one, and it's difficult. We had a sign on a big old eucalypt in our garden that used to say this tree is 300 years old, but nobody knew. And in Australia, we often don't have the really strong seasonal changes in our climate, so we right. don't get counting growth rings, even on a core of, you know, you can use an increment or a device and take a core sample out of a tree and count growth rings. But on our eucalypts in particular, that doesn't often match up, because the trees put on different amounts of growth depending on how much rain they've had and whether it's been drought. So even in 1 year, you could have three, and you just over 100 years, it's not accurate at all. So the answer is often quite ambiguous, and then leads to more questions, which is great. I just think it just, the more questions that come, the more you get to engage with people.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the biggest misconceptions?
I mean, I've touched on tree risk, but I won't go into that too much, because, you know, like I said, it's infinitesimally small, the risk of being harmed by a tree. Yet often people, I worked for someone who wouldn't let their kids sleep in the top floor room when there was a storm. You know, yet that tree was perfectly optimized and an amazing tree. It wasn't ever likely to cause any issues. But the ones that are funny is, like, people still have the, you know, the carrot analogy of the roots. Like, what is below ground in a tree is mm-hmm. a mirror of what is above ground. And you see some great drawings on the internet, you know, people, you even have them in logos for arboriculture companies, where they show this carrot like root structure. And, you know, trees roots on mass may equal the above ground mass, but below ground they're limited by the amount of oxygen in the soil, which is normally, there's not much below 500 millimeters, a couple of feet. But yet they tend to spread out. The roots go far, far beyond the drip line. I just did inverted commas there, of the tree. And, you know, they can stretch out for hundreds of meters, and microscopic little roots that you wouldn't even be aware of in the ground if you dug a hole. So that's always a really cool one. And then I kind of find that the funny thing is that we still have this funny, the lollipop vision of a tree, you know.
So
one
true.
single straight stem with a bunch of foliage up top, and trees just don't grow like that. Yeah, there are some species that have great form. There's a lot of conifers that have the triangle Christmas tree shape, but even then, you know, they often have multi stems. Sometimes there's several stems or trunks coming from the base, and yet we all still have this image in our mind's eye of a tree, like how a young child would draw a tree. And I love challenging that. There's some fantastic species that people want to look like that, and they all want them pruned like that. But when you can get them to see how wonderful multiple trunks and trees growing together rather than just one-off single trees can be a beautiful thing. So, yeah, there's lots of misconceptions. And that's one of the joys of the job is showing people the other side.
Yeah, and I would imagine that when those misconceptions are debunked, that people are quite impressed, and it creates this lasting impression. I mean, what else have you found really sticks with people in terms of in-field experiences with trees?
Yeah, I think I touched on it slightly just earlier, where I'm amazed how few people have truly come across big old trees.
Yeah, like true old growth.
Yeah, and you know, of course, that's our society. We've logged most of the big old forests all around the world, but there's still these amazing remnant trees out there. And I mean, you North America and Europe have trees in the urban landscape that are hundreds of years old. In Australia, we sort of don't have that so much. But then when you can show people just truly what a big old tree looks like, and then explain to them that the tree may be hundreds of years old, that's amazing. And when people are lucky enough to and privileged enough to be able to go to big old growth forests, it's humbling. It's really humbling. Like everybody I know that's been to a giant sequoia forest or a coast redwood forest or some of the big old eucalypt forests, it puts them in their little, like makes you realize where you sit in the world. But it's something where I think it's often life-changing people, especially if you get to hug one of those trees. And again, that's where my less scientific hippie side comes in. Hug the tree, really, really connect with it. And yeah, I think that leaves such a lasting impression on people. But and then hopefully leads them planting trees, because I mean, I still remember the first tree I planted as a little kid. It was an Arbor Day tree where, you know, they give schools these trees. And yeah, I think it was an Acacia baileyana, Acuta mundra wattle, which is an Australian native and fast growing acacia. And yeah, just I remember it. I remember it having this distinct feathery foliage in its juvenile leaves, and then seeing it a few years later when I went back to that house with my parents to visit it, and sort of being like, wow, I planted that. That must have been in the bicentennial for Australia in 1988. So showing my age there, but a while ago.
There are only small patches of light hitting the forest floor in this more mature section of woods. Owing to a gentle breeze above, the dappled light dances across the leaf litter.
Switching to outdoor and environmental educators, which is our core listenership, how would you suggest that they incorporate trees into their teaching? I mean, obviously trees are ubiquitous in most landscapes around the world, unless you're in more subarctic and arctic type landscapes. What would be some starting points that you would recommend?
Yeah, it's great that on the point that that trees are ubiquitous in the landscape, they're such a great gateway into plants, into conservation, into biology, and even into our urban landscape and discussions around sustainability and all of that. So I think there's sort of so many ways that educators can bring trees in, whether it's with young children, getting them to understand, you know, to climb and engage with trees, to understand those really simple concepts about photosynthesis, whether it's biology and you know, the idea that the tree is, you know, drawing how evapotranspiration works and cools the environment, and linking these great things into photosynthesis and the little machines in the leaves that are making energy, you know, taking the sun's light and mixing that with water and sugar. And, you know, it's a really, because they're just, I think trees are just a big example of woody plants. You know, they're obvious. They makes it a lot easier for people to get those concepts across. But then there's the benefits of trees. You know, they're this idea that in the world, it's great when I hear teachers getting young kids to understand how the trees are cooling their environment, providing ecosystem services and habitat for not just the big obvious things like be they birds and the bigger animals, but right down through to fungi. And then how trees fit in the ecosystem. I think that's, you know, it's sort of got it all. Again, trees just, they're this great vehicle for all of that. And there's so many good resources out there for all of those things, be it through botanic gardens, through arborists, engaging with arboriculture is a profession that's just constantly evolving at a rate of knots, you know, whether it's the International Society of Arboriculture in North America and some other organizations that are just running really high level education for professionals. And those people are incredibly in tune. They're tree people to begin with, and they'll talk to, like me, they'll talk to any educator about trees for hours, and they'll provide a wealth of resources and connections into that. Yeah, so many ways.
This is maybe a bit of a curveball, but you mentioned that these are for people who are already interested in trees. How do we get to, and this is, I'm always toying with this, you know, how do we get to the uninitiated, the people who maybe just don't give trees a passing glance? I mean, have you ever had experiences where you were able to, I don't want to say convert someone, but for lack of a better term, that sort of is what we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, a lot's been written in recent years about the concepts of plant blindness.
Yes.
And in particular, tree blindness. I mean, even when my background was in conventional horticulture, and an arborist that was a great teacher of arboriculture in Sydney, and where I was studying and working at the time, he said to my boss, he's sort of, we had him out consulting, looking at some trees, and he turned to me and said, you know, I know you want to be a great horticulturist, but how can you be a great horticulturist if you don't look up? And he said, you've got to come and study trees. So I did. And I was blind to trees, yet I was a horticulturist. And I think that's the first bit, is we sort of need to get people to see trees. You know, they're everywhere, you said, they're ubiquitous in the landscape, and they're doing all these wonderful things for us, be that providing shade, you know, even increasing the property value in our houses. There's a lot of people that they're not going to think in terms of, like, yeah, the plant people are preaching to the choir kind of things easy, like you said.
Yeah.
But the people that aren't engaged or don't see it, I think we need to try to find their language and make that connection and get them to understand in their terms. Some people it's a purely economic thing, and some people it's maybe an aesthetic thing. Some people it's just they don't have time in their lives to, or the opportunity. You know, there's a lot of disadvantaged people that from disadvantaged communities that just don't have trees in their environment. So planting trees with people, getting people to have opportunity to come and see amazing trees, to facilitate places and spaces to have the conversations around them, and then to get them to be able to hug them and make their own personal connections. I think that's always the starting point. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of tree people like me preaching.
Yeah, I mean, it's always easy to talk to a captive audience of people who already have that interest. And you make a great point. It's putting it into the language of other communities, what resonates with them, whether, as you said, it's economic or aesthetic and so on.
He pauses to focus on the carpet of leaf litter and the remarkable network of roots beneath his feet. It's here where so much communication happens among trees and with fungi. And there's surely so much yet to be discovered.
Let's end with a mention of a project that you're really excited about, an upcoming project that's coming this spring and summer.
Okay, I might push it a little bit and mention too, just because one of them's definitely a work in progress, but it's something important to a lot of us in Australia. And that's our gardens is working on a First Nations multi-naming process where we're looking at trying, building out relationships with Australian Aboriginal communities. And we manage three gardens. There's the Royal Botanic Garden Sydney, there's the Our Australian Botanic Gardens in Mount Annan in Western Sydney, which is our native garden. And then there's Mount Tomar Blue Mountains Botanic Gardens up in the Blue Mountains, just west of Sydney. And across those, our gardens sit on land that was traditionally owned by several different Aboriginal nations and language groups. There's the Gadigal people in Sydney, and then the Darwal, Gundungurra and Darug people at Mount Annan, and then the Darug people up in the Blue Mountains Botanic Gardens. And yeah, as we build our relationships with community and work towards reconciliation with those people, we're trying to look at promoting their traditional nations for names of plants and on into our scientific naming conventions that we use to name the plants in the botanic gardens. And it's a really interesting thing, and it's something that we're really excited. It'll take time, and we're trying to make sure that the Darug people have first say in how we do that. So yeah, it might not be done by this summer, but it's really exciting. There might be some wonderful trees, some eucalypts or angophoras, some great things up here where hopefully the Darug people will share their names for those plants and we'll be able to get those onto our labels and make this very symbolic and important gesture of doing that. So yeah, that's something that's really exciting. But then the other one is I've just spent a week away at a conference down in Melbourne, which was the Botanic Gardens International Congress, and it was absolutely inspiring, and there was some fantastic talks by some people from a Global Trees campaign, which is run through Botanic Gardens Conservation International, some arboreta like Morton Arboretum in America and Western Burt Arboretum in the UK, and they've done this huge assessment of the state of tree species in the world, and there's some sad things that have come out of it, but they're saying, you know, a quarter of the world's tree species are facing extinction. But it was really pragmatic. Then they've done all this wonderful work for Botanic Gardens to look at how we can best conserve species and prioritizing things for us. And the Blue Mountains Botanic Gardens was impacted by the 2019 Black Summer bushfires, and what bore the brunt of that in our collections were the North American tree collection. So yeah, as we clean up the damage from that, and sort of we're redesigning and looking at our living collection, and we had this sort of North American tree collection, but what we're hoping to do is work with the amazing work these scientists and arborists and all of that have done, and look at how we can best rebuild our North American collection so that it's really valuable to the conservation of North American trees. And yeah, that's just going to be really exciting. I mean, I actually, one of my fellow arborists down at the Royal Botanic Gardens Melbourne had just imported some threatened oaks, a Southern Californian oak called Quercus engelmannii, and
yeah,
they grew those on from seed. And then when we left the conference, yeah, he gave me four to bring back up. So I nursed these little babies, these sort of rare trees, on the plane with me, and I've just dropped them off in our nursery quarantine area today. So, and they're also really well suited to a changing climate. So we're going to get those out, and hopefully it's just the beginning of our collaborations with all these wonderful tree people around the world to save and conserve more trees.
Wow, that's really amazing. Are there any, I hadn't thought to ask this, but are there any North American tree species that are naturalized in your area or even maybe growing in your botanic garden?
Yeah, so we don't have too many that are naturalized. We're actually in the middle of the World Heritage Wilderness Area, surrounded by national parks on all sides. We manage any weed escapees very carefully, but yeah, we're our garden is a cool climate garden with a focus on trees and plants from around the world to make the most of our climate that we have here and sort of grow and conserve things that might be very difficult to grow in the rest of Australia. So our garden can actually provide a really fantastic sort of biorefuge for us to be able to secure the genetic material of things that are threatened from all around the world, because we've sort of got this buffer of the national park around us. We're up in a mountain range, and then we're on an island that's very far away from the rest of the world, being Australia. So yeah, we've got some fantastic North American conifer species. We've got a great collection of deciduous trees, some of the rare ash trees. So yeah, it's an amazing, every time I go out in the garden, I look up and see a tree that I've probably walked past 100 times before, and it's all new to me, so yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that's the thing, given the diversity of plants, there is never a dull moment, and we're very thankful for that. Well, from one Ian to another, thank you so much for sharing your stories and insights all about seeing the world through trees. There's a lot we can learn from them if we just pause and look.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Ian. I really appreciate the opportunity to have a chat about trees.
As he contemplates the awesome potential for further discovery, he is reminded that the finer workings of intricate root systems are so often overlooked, especially among lay people. How best can he engage the uninitiated with this fascinating hidden world? Exploring this question will be his mission for the rest of the morning. He continues his bushwalk. Talking with Green Teachers is co-hosted by Ian Shanahan and me, Sofia Vargas-Nesi. Ian is the show's writer and editor. Logo design is by Devin Terrien. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes to get instant access to each new episode. If you really like the show, give us a rating too. We can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us in this episode. We'll chat again soon.